suburban life, so much is the same. Week after week. Who hasn't had the impulse to put their life on hold for a moment? Just vanish completely. My wife's first call would be to my office.
No, he hasn't come in. No, he didn't say anything.
Car's still there.
The plot thickens.
How far am I willing to let this go?
Welcome to the Literary Hangover. I'm your host, Matt Leck. With me is Alex and Grace.
Hey.
Hi.
Hey, you guys. Thank you for joining me once again. Today, we are discussing two books, really. The first is Wakefield by Nathaniel Hawthorne, originally published in New England Magazine in 1835, and then republished in Twice Told Tales in 1837. And we're also talking about Henry James's Hawthorne, which, when did that come out?
1879.
Oh, okay. Wow. You had something to say, Alex?
No, that was good. I was like, Grace, you should have been like, it was actually a year before Portrait of the Lady.
It was.
Yeah, we've all read the Wikipedia page. Okay, we know.
So that's the dates portion covered.
Great.
It's going to be a loose one.
Going to be a bit loosey-goosey. We already have bourbon and Modelo boxes. I was entirely sober for One Hans
Fall. My
whole
life.
I was sober for the Edgar Allan Poe one,
yeah, that was
ironic.
I think we were both...
if you think about it.
How is that ironic?
Because Edgar Allan Poe drank a lot.
Oh, yeah. Okay, you died of alcoholism.
Is a joke.
Yeah,
I guess.
That is ironic.
Yeah, no, we shouldn't joke about that.
That episode
is ironic,
painfully sober, actually.
It was, yeah.
Like, just, you can tell it's a dry one.
Yeah. It was very, but we did it, though.
Yeah.
We are going to listen to another full-length short story this time.
I was hoping you're going to do the book. It would be like 5.5 hours.
Which book?
The Hawthorne one. The Henry James one.
Oh, yeah. No, not that full thing. I don't think we need to do that. That'd be a bit indulgent. No, we're Wakefield. Which is maybe Hawthorne's most interesting short story. Nodding doesn't pick up well on these new mics. But both Alex and Grace were nodding in assent there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're just like, we heard what you said. I don't know if I would make a blanket statement like that so quickly.
I'm going to compress that so much so you can hear your vertebrae actually like flexing.
Yeah, that's good. People love that.
I'm somewhat distracted by the cat.
Yeah, Barnaby's got his perch on the winter coats. He's overlooking everything.
He wants my down jacket.
It's not gonna. Yeah, it'll happen. Just, you know.
It'd be nice if we could teach him to, like, Google things while we're podcasting.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we're going to start, I think, with discussing Henry James's Hawthorne, just to get into more biographical detail of Hawthorne. Although, my experience with reading this was that it says almost as much about Henry James as it does about Nathaniel Hawthorne. Would you agree, Grace?
For sure. I read this basically as James's attempt, one attempt of many that he made throughout his career to define himself through his kind of critique and criticism of others. I think that comes through really strongly in this piece, particularly his attempt to define himself against what he sees as a more primitive version of American literature.
I mean, he even mentions a couple times the term realism. And how Hawthorne himself probably wouldn't have been familiar with it at that time. Like, it's interesting, you know, we hear about these terms, you know, getting taught, but to see them actually used by the artists as they were practicing kind of makes them seem a little bit more relevant, I guess.
You mean James or Hawthorne?
James.
Yeah.
Like, self-consciously, he talks about how, like, Hawthorne... it doesn't really include like the research that you would have in like a realistic novel in realism. Is that right?
Yeah, and he's also kind of interested in how Hawthorne uses allegory and symbolism, and that's one of the problems that he finds with Hawthorne, I think, that his tendency to rely on symbols, James, I think, perceives as not very sophisticated.
I have this. This is from Henry James's Hawthorne by Dan McCall, which is in the New England Review in 1997. To quote from Dan McCall, when Hawthorne first appeared in December of 1879, there was considerable public outcry against James's severe tone and general condescension. Who was this traitor to his native land, this expatriate snob who had gone British and thumbed his London nose at his predecessor's achievement? In January of the new year, James wrote to William Dean Howells that the American critics were bloodhounds, furiously drenching the decent public with his gore. In an anonymous review in The Atlantic the following month, Howells said that in some quarters, James would be found guilty of high treason. Harper's hoped that the book had been written only in a momentary fit of indigestion. James called these reviews a melancholy revelation of angry vanity, vulgarity, and innocence. He said, I thought they would protest a good deal at my calling New England life unfurnished, but I did not expect they would lose their heads and their manners at such a rate. He drew himself up, prepared to do battle for most of the convictions expressed in his little book, but willing to admit some minor faults. He wrote to Howells, it is quite true that I used the word provincial too many times. I hated myself for it, even while I did it, just as I overdo the epithet dusky. Still, he hoped the clamor was, quote, a very big tempest in a very small teapot. And he complained, what a public to write for. He hoped they are not the real American public. If I thought they were, I would give up the country.
Which he did later, by the way.
Who needed such a, quote, clucking...
Get him.
Clucking of a brood of prairie hens.
Yes.
Ooh.
So, yeah, and this came early in James's career, right? Like, had he published... I'm fairly unfamiliar with James. So you said this was before Portrait of a Lady. How well known was he at this time?
He had a pretty substantial profile at this point, but he hadn't, I guess, hit his stride as a novelist. He'd definitely published a lot already, and he was extremely prolific kind of throughout his career. You know, he wrote for 51 years of his life. Dozens of novels and plays and stories and critical essays. So yeah, he did have some profile at this point in his career. And of course, Portrait of a Lady would be published the following year.
I really admired the American intelligentsia being like, oh, you're shit-talking Hawthorne, huh? Well, that's our guy. Like, it's almost like a... like some sort of sports rivalry, being like, you wouldn't believe the analysis that this SOB is doing or across the pond, talking about our country, our head writer, like get the fuck out of our face.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what kind of defensiveness that is, like, because it's hard, because America just doesn't have this position anymore. Now we're like the world power. We're not like, you know what I'm saying? Like that sense of, There's no history that has happened here that's gone now. I don't think they're so preoccupied with how much more there is. We'll play that clip about the laundry list of things that aren't in America.
Yeah, it is a laundry list, isn't it?
To enter as closely as possible into Hawthorne's situation, one must endeavor to reproduce his circumstances. We are struck with a large number of elements that were absent from them. And the coldness, the thinness, the blankness, to repeat my epithet, present themselves so vividly that our foremost feeling is that of compassion for a romancer looking for subjects in such a field. It takes so many things, as Hawthorne must have felt later in life, when he made the acquaintance of the denser, rich, warmer European spectacle. It takes such an accumulation of history and custom, such a complexity of manners and types, to form a fund of suggestion for a novelist. If Hawthorne had been a young Englishman or a young Frenchman of the same degree of genius, the same cast of mind, the same habits, his consciousness of the world around him would have been a very different affair. However obscure, however reserved his own personal life, his sense of the life of his fellow mortals would have been almost infinitely more various. The negative side of the spectacle on which Hawthorne looked out, in his contemplative saunterings and reveries, might indeed, with a little ingenuity, be made almost ludicrous. One might enumerate the items of high civilization, as it exists in other countries, which are absent from the texture of American life, until it should become a wonder to know what was left. No state, in the European sense of the word, and indeed barely a specific national name. No sovereign, no court, no personal loyalty, no aristocracy, no church, no clergy, no army, no diplomatic service, no country gentlemen, no palaces, no castles, nor manors, nor old country houses, nor parsonages, nor thatched cottages, nor ivied ruins, no cathedrals, nor abbeys, nor little Norman churches, no great universities, nor public schools, no Oxford, nor Eton, nor Harrow, no literature, no novels, no museums, no pictures, no political society, no sporting class, no Epsom, nor Ascot. Some such list as that might be drawn up of the absent things in American life, especially in the American life of 40 years ago, the effect of which upon an English or a French imagination would probably, as a general thing, be appalling. The natural remark, in the almost lurid light of such an indictment, would be that if these things are left out, everything is left out. The American knows that a good deal remains. What it is that remains, that is his secret, his joke, as one may say. It would be cruel in this terrible denudation to deny him the consolation of his national gift, that American humor, of which of late years we've heard so much.
So, yeah, what were people upset about?
I mean, show me the lie. Is there Oxford in America? Maybe I missed that. I mean, no. Ascots? No.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, Harvard's been around for a long time, right? Since the 1600s.
Yes, well, I mean, look who it produces, though.
Yeah.
Emerson.
I mean, that is like, remember the Sidney Smith who reads an American novel?
Oh, yeah.
Sidney Smith pissed off Americans. He comes up every once in a while. I've seen him since then.
Such a good pastime for like the English intelligentsia to like poke this very self-conscious bear.
There's also this bit here where he's talking about Salem.
The dreary and unprosperous condition that he speaks of in regard to the fortunes of his family is an allusion to the fact that several generations followed each other on the soil in which they'd been planted, that during the 18th century a succession of Hawthornes trod the simple streets of Salem without ever conferring any especial luster upon the town, or receiving, presumably, any great delight from it. 100 years of Salem would perhaps be rather a dead weight for any family to carry, and we venture to imagine that the Hawthornes were dull and depressed. They did what they could, however, to improve their situation. They trod the Salem streets as little as possible. They went to sea and made long voyages. Seamanship became the regular profession of the family. Hawthorne has said it in charming language. From father to son, for above 100 years, they followed the sea. A gray-headed shipmaster in each generation, retiring from the quarter-deck to the homestead, while a boy of 14 took the hereditary place before the mast, confronting the salt spray and the gale which had blustered against his sire and grandsire. The boy.
Yeah, like Hawthorne's dad died of yellow fever in Suriname when he was a young boy, in fact. So yeah, it's really bore in there, so you basically do a very dangerous job because
it's have suicidal tendencies, basically.
Basically the entire world at this point was ice road truckers.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Like you gotta move, you gotta transport shit, and that is a very drunk dangerous elephant. Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, like we mentioned, Hawthorne's dad brought the first elephant to the United States.
First alcoholic elephant.
Well, yeah, but when they, that was only.
That wasn't planned.
Yeah.
The aftermath.
That was because they forgot to bring enough water for it to drink. You don't, look, it's the first time.
It's hard to make fun of this country, I gotta say.
You have to learn from experience.
Yeah.
And how are you gonna know if you gotta move an elephant from, you know, like India or somewhere, wherever.
It's a long way. That's a lot of water.
You don't think about it.
No, you don't. Like, we have all this rubbing alcohol. Let's give him that.
Fine. It's like a camel, right?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. What else do we want to hit on with this Henry James?
Interested to talk about this one because I know that you have a particular affinity with Henry James. And I'm sure
affinity is a rather strong word.
Yeah. We'll be talking about him, I'm sure, in the future in much more depth.
Mm.
But I'm curious if you were to introduce someone to Henry James, how would you go about it?
That's a good question. I think I got interested in Henry James out of a kind of misguided intellectual bravado, basically. I had heard that
he was... It's the right podcast for that.
Yeah, exactly. I had heard that he was a quote-unquote difficult writer, and, you know, people talk about him as a writer's writer. Like, there are several contemporary novelists who have talked about how much they admire James, and I think throughout the 20th century he attracted a great many kind of high literary admirers, from T.S. Eliot all the way through to, in the present day, people like John Banville and Colm Tóibín as well. And so I think when I was young, doing my English degree, I was drawn to that just because it sounded like a fun challenge. As I read more and more of his stuff, I realized that I actually prefer his nonfiction to his fiction, with the exception of The Portrait of a Lady, which I do think is a masterpiece and kind of deserves its place in American and Anglophone literary history. But his critical essays, his travel writing, his prefaces to his own work, which he published in 1907 in the New York edition of his novels, I think are just amazing. And the thing that I love most about his writing is that you really can see his mind working on the page in a way that you can't with a lot of writers. His writing is very alive with kind of inference and suggestion and innuendo, and that's part of what drives some people crazy about his prose, that it's actually kind of a little bit evasive and suggestive and circular. But I think if you're somebody who enjoys just like sinking into some really good writing, he's a great one. His later novels, though, are basically impenetrable. Even really? After reading most of his early work, his later style was extremely ambiguous and, I would use that word again, evasive.
Yeah, I feel like I've only read like a collection of his short stories, but I feel like he writes the way that like how Ruskin would describe like architecture, like ornamentation, that like that's what you're enjoying the construction for. Like, I've never read a short story by an author that I felt so confidently like in the writer's hands of like,
yes,
like I'm going to take you along to this point, and yes, like, and you're probably be expecting this, we're going to get this. I'm just like, just being seen essentially by someone who's long dead.
Yeah, that is the great pleasure of reading James for me still. Sounds cheesy, but I feel like I'm taking a bath every time.
I want to also play this part. This is a part you flagged in the group chat, Grace, about being the young man in business.
Ways of enjoying life, and that of the artist is one of the most innocent. But for all that, it connects itself with the idea of pleasure. He proposes to give pleasure. And to give it, he must first get it. Where he gets it will depend upon circumstances, and circumstances were not encouraging to Hawthorne. He was poor, he was solitary, and he undertook to devote himself to literature in a community in which the interest in literature was as yet of the smallest. It is not too much to say that even to the present day it is a considerable discomfort in the United States not to be in business. The young man who attempts to launch himself in a career that does not belong to the so-called practical order, the young man who has not, in a word, an office in the business quarter of the town, with his name painted on the door, has but a limited place in the social system, finds no particular bow to perch upon. He's not looked at askance. He is not regarded as an idler. Literature and the arts have always been held in extreme honor in the American world, and those who practice them are received on easier terms than in other countries. If the tone of the American world is in some respects provincial, it is in none more so than in this matter of the exaggerated homage rendered to authorship. The gentleman or the lady who's written a book is in many circles the object of an admiration too indiscriminating to operate as an encouragement to good writing.
This is really good stuff, I think. I really like this take.
There is no reason to suppose that this was less the case 50 years ago. But 50 years ago, greatly more than now, the literary man must have lacked the comfort and inspiration of belonging to a class. The best things come as a general thing from the talents that are members of a group. Every man works better when he has companions working in the same line and yielding the stimulus of suggestion, comparison, emulation. Great things, of course, have been done by solitary workers, but they've usually been done with double the pains they would have cost if they'd been produced in more genial circumstances. The solitary worker loses the profit of example and discussion. He's apt to make awkward experiments. He's in the nature of the case more or less of an empiric. The empiric may, as I say, be treated by the world as an expert, but the drawbacks and discomforts of empiricism remain to him, and are in fact increased by the suspicion that is mingled with his gratitude of a want in the public taste of a sense of the proportions of things.
That's really interesting to me, because we're going to talk about, I think, well, a couple of different Orwell essays. I want to do The Lion and the Unicorn, and then we also want to do... is it Spilling the Spanish Beans or...
I think it's just Reflections on the Spanish Civil War.
Okay, yeah. I'm also reading a book by Philip Bound called Orwell and Marxism, or Marx and Orwell, or something like that. And Orwell was in conversation or writing in reply to a lot of different like left-wing thought at the time. And what we have is like 50 George Orwell essays of him like during the war or leading up to the war or in the 30s, right? Like during the Spanish Civil War. It makes him look like a genius, but then you realize certain arguments come from this writer. Certain arguments basically come from a review of this book that he reviewed. But because the author gets sort of like subsumes everything, they get credit for way more of that than they really should. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true of basically every writer. Basically, what you have the platform, right? Mm-hmm. So you can steal your friend's observations,
yeah.
Or even if they're other journalists, like a lot of novelists are, right? Like you hear a bunch of shit and you can just use that.
It's almost like the name is just an organizing principle for this like milieu of thought at the time.
Exactly. The corporate author, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. For the weirdest reason, reading this book, I kept thinking of the Anne Bradstreet poems we read. Because she was describing this time in poetry where the English and American cultures were a single culture, like a monoculture. And then we were talking, I think, in the episode about that culture being severed due to the revolutionary period. And America had to create its own monoculture, basically. Mm-hmm. Now reading this feels like the first cultural attempt that maybe not implicitly, but weaving these cultures together to bring America, maybe even like germate is maybe the better word, that like the American germ is spreading out beyond its confines in the latter half of the 19th century. And there's going to be this there's going to be this stitching together of like the old world with this new American sentiment.
And Henry James is doing that stitching, you're saying?
Yeah.
He is an emissary, I think, at least at this point in his career, when he's identifying as basically a transatlantic literary figure as opposed to a more English one, which I think he will towards the end of his life.
Yeah, like I don't know if it's necessarily like not an active mission for him to be like, we want to mix these two cultures together, but the fact that he's sees them of value comparing them, like the fact that he is denigrating American culture so much makes me think that he's under the impression that America has work to be done or else it's not worth criticizing. You know, like it has a place in this pantheon of culture.
And it's interesting to me the way he talks about Hawthorne as a provincial American, but like the last part of the book is about Hawthorne going to Europe. And like you said, that's something James did himself. It's almost like James recognized in Hawthorne, like even though he's sort of delineating what the different projects they have in terms of their art, there's certain tracks that they're on nonetheless, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Doesn't he say in the book that he's like, when Hawthorne went to England, or went to Europe, unfortunately, he went too late because he went when he was 50 and he didn't have a chance for the European culture to really get into him. He's already set in his ways.
He already had his ideas formed by that point.
Yeah, yeah.
She's like, well, that's perfect for you, isn't it, Henry?
Right, exactly. Just trying to get over there.
Yeah, yeah.
I just want to read a little quote from some of Henry James's travel writing. So this is a quote from his essay on London. And Alex, what you were saying just a moment ago made me think of this. So he's in London writing about it, and he says this: I like to think how great we all are together in the light of heaven and the face of the rest of the world, with the bond of our glorious tongue, in which we labor to write articles and books for each other's candid perusal. How great we all are, and how great is the city, which we may unite fraternally to regard as the capital of our race. A very explicit attempt to kind of knit together American and English literary culture. Mm. And, you know, that last word, race, as well, being kind of interesting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that is interesting. I know that that's like in the soup in America, like post, when was that written?
This will have been, I think, at the very end of the century.
Oh, okay. Because like 1870s or so, like right after the Civil War, the United States takes this outward turn where it's like, we're a world power, basically, that is going to be involved with other world powers, and we need to set up our country in a way that is like, has a certain level of prestige. Like, that's how like museums are founded, and that's how like certain art institutions are built, with the idea of being like, of trying to emulate this success that Henry James is saying is completely lacking in the American scene. Like, in a way, like, yeah, he is condescending, but like the period he's talking about is somewhat correct, that there isn't this like massive art culture happening in the first half of the 19th century in the United States like there is in Europe.
And another interesting contradiction there is that, however condescending and patronizing he is when it comes to America in this period, the fact of the matter is all of his heroines are, or basically all of his heroines are, young American women who go out to Europe, whose innocence is corrupted by, you know, European decadence and wisdom and sophistication. And his sympathies are with those heroines, I think.
Mm-hmm.
His subjectivity is filtered through them. And so you have this kind of tension in his work between identification with this American innocence and a kind of darker knowledge that he is using to kind of delineate both, you know.
Yeah. I like that.
In the article I cited earlier, Dan McCall or something like that, he also makes a point about Hawthorne, that at the time that James was writing this, Hawthorne's stories for children were just as much a part of his oeuvre popularly as his, you know, Scarlet Letter and that stuff. Mm-hmm. It's a very Victorian view of him, where it's like he's got the children's stories and he's got these stories for adults.
Hmm.
And doesn't James talk about how he read those stories as a child?
Yeah, yes. I think so, yeah.
And that they left a really deep impression on him.
Yeah, and children's literature is a huge thing in like the 1830s. That's what we were doing instead of like art. We were like making stuff for the kids, because I think Sedgwick does some of that. I think Lydia Maria Child does that. They just go into like basically like children's books. I mean, the needs for a country at that time, right? You can see why they did that. But yeah, Hawthorne really like that. I think that those children's stories were what made him the most money, at least during his lifetime.
Hmm.
More than the custom house salary.
Yeah. Well, I have some notes on, do we want to say anything more on Henry James?
And so much more.
Okay, yeah. Let's go on.
But I think there's like a game of cat and mouse going on in this biography of Hawthorne, which is, why is he writing this exactly? And you can see it's what makes him, at least this piece, quite interesting, is it's not even clear to the author, I don't know if it's a conceit or not, why he's reviewing him, or maybe why even he likes Hawthorne anymore. Like, at this moment in Henry James's life, he when he goes into detail about like the American novels, he refers to The Scarlet Letter as his greatest work and his personal favorite, but also a very good second-rate novel. And he always ends his like analysis as like, I don't really know why I like this. He doesn't literally say that, but he essentially ends up with that position on like a multiple of Hawthorne's work. And it's like, he can't, if you really did grow up with him, it's like there's something primordial about Hawthorne that's in Henry James's DNA that he can't analyze correctly.
Yes, definitely. And I think also that he, for as much ambivalence as he has towards Hawthorne, ultimately he is championing him in this biography as like the best example that we have at this period of American literature. And at one point he says that of The Scarlet Letter, something might at last be sent to Europe as exquisite in quality as anything that had been received. And the best of it was that the thing was absolutely American. It belonged to the soil, to the air. It came out of the very heart of New England. And so I think, you know, he's like very much up for this novel being kind of having a cultural diplomacy role in Europe for American literature.
Yeah, I got a similar note from, this is from Henry James's Hawthorne by Matthew Peters this time. Same title for the article as earlier. This one in the Cambridge Quarterly, December 2013. This is how it begins. In 1879, Henry James was contracted by Macmillan and Company to write a monograph on Nathaniel Hawthorne. James wrote to Hawthorne's son, Julian Hawthorne, that he had taken on the commission reluctantly, believing that whatever were his qualifications for writing about Hawthorne, it, quote, seemed that it should, if possible, be done by an American. James felt that Hawthorne's work could be best interpreted by a reader who was familiar with American, and specifically New England, society. As he would write in Hawthorne, it is an almost indispensable condition of properly appreciating Hawthorne to have received a personal impression of the manners, the morals, indeed of the very climate, of the great region of which the remarkable city of Boston is the metropolis. These were the conditions of life which, as James later wrote in Notes of a Son and Brother, Hawthorne experienced as an American who proved to what use American matter could be put by an American hand, and who showed that an American could be an artist, one of the finest, without going outside about it.
I liked how I think it's the Brook Farm chapter, he essentially takes on Hawthorne's prejudices as well, with his personal grudges, because he always had like a give and take with Emerson where they seemed friendly, but they respected each other's opinions very much. And Henry James, without even thinking about it, immediately kind of takes up Hawthorne's criticisms of Emerson, basically saying that like he wasn't even a real abolitionist. Like, he came on late in the game, basically, when it became popular. And he's like, Hawthorne's a gentleman because he stuck by his principles, even though they were unpopular at the time. Yeah. Which we're talking about, like, you know, massive sedition, like civil war.
Yeah, that's like such the 19th century for you. Like, just do your part, just play, like, do your duty.
That's now, or I feel like that's like centrist Democrats right now.
Yeah.
Being like
civility discourse,
yeah, that kind of thing, or of like yeah, okay, AOC can keep talking, but you know, we're gonna be people who actually make change, not people who just talk all day or whatever, who just excite people and get people to vote for them,
right.
I think it's kind of interesting how he used the word democratic in this biography. Did you pick up on that at all, Alex? He talks about Hawthorne existing in a democratic society in New England.
I know there was a reference to the many-headed monster of universal suffrage, which must have been a specter of universal suffrage.
Remember we played the Many-Headed Hydra by Peter Lindbaugh? That was a common metaphor.
Oh, yeah.
They always use that shit.
Yeah. I've noticed that he brought it up as a, like, exotic term.
Yeah. This is the quote. He says, he lived in the most democratic and most virtuous of modern communities. And then later he says that Hawthorne was thoroughly American in all ways. He was in none more so than in the vagueness of his sense of social distinction. And so I kind of read this as James, again, implicitly contrasting American society in this period with European society. And like what he says when he talks about the that laundry list of things that American society lacks that Europe has, he's basically bemoaning the lack of social distinction, of like social or class-based complexity in American society. And that, I think, is how he defines democracy, kind of negatively, through what is happening in Europe.
Right, yeah, just like a hodgepodge of individuals that are like firing off like atoms, basically.
Because I think for James, a precondition of his fiction is these like dark, murky, indistinct social hierarchies that he finds in Europe, and which he's so attracted to and mm-hmm. seduced by, but I think he doesn't, fundamentally, he's always striving to understand them. And, you know, coming from England and having a very tricky relationship to the British class system, as I think a lot of English expats do, and probably English people in England as well, I can definitely relate to that sense of being somehow like bewildered by what you find in class in the UK, compared to in America, where there is this idea of like distinctions not really mattering and, you know, self-fashioning.
Well, I guess that, yeah, that's the heart of the matter for this topic, is that you are like you have a Henry James-esque life in reverse, where you're coming from that wonderful class country into this many-headed Hydra democracy, I guess is what it's supposed to be at this moment. Do you feel like you relate to Henry James in that way? Or do you, like, when you read, do you see him as like a comrade of someone who, you know, who's living that's not a bi-coastal life, what do you call it? Just like an Erasmian
transatlantic life. Yeah, I think in a way I relate on some level, because what Henry James is so drawn to in Europe and in the UK is what has kind of like made fleeing that scene so attractive for me. And especially like reading his letters from England and his travel writing from that period, I'm just, so little seems to have changed, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems unrecognizable. Or at least America seems unrecognizable, the one he's describing. Does it to you, Matt? Like the one, some of the, like the self-consciousness of like, no, we're just as good as anyone else, that he, provincialism they seem to discuss.
Yeah, it's so insecure. I think
it was a through line with today too.
I think it's historically contingent. I think I read that it was during Andrew Jackson's time that America eclipsed Britain in terms of population. And then the next decades are basically eclipsing it as a industrial power, basically. But it's not conscious of that. Like it's not aware that it's going to just do that. It's still Britain is still Britain. Mm-hmm. And I think now, I don't think it's the same now. I don't think America's insecure in that way. I mean maybe countries are just insulate themselves from criticism either way, regardless of if they're on top or not, mm-hmm. or if they're have an inferiority complex. It doesn't really matter what arguments they're making. It's just you want to insulate yourself from the criticism. So like it's sort of the pathology is sort of dependent on, is there a bigger fish in the pond, basically? I don't know. I do have this part about the, it's where he's talking about the Pierce biography, and he talks about universal suffrage.
Mm-hmm.
On the 4th of March, 1853, his old college mate and intimate friend, Franklin Pierce, was installed as President of the United States. He'd been the candidate of the Democratic Party, and all good Democrats, accordingly, in conformity to the beautiful and rational system, under which the affairs of the Great Republic were carried on, began to open their windows to the golden sunshine of presidential patronage. When General Pierce was put forward by the Democrats, Hawthorne felt a perfectly loyal and natural desire that his good friend should be exalted to so brilliant a position, and he did what was in him to further the good cause by writing a little book about his hero. His Life of Franklin Pierce belongs to that class of literature which is known as the campaign biography, and which consists of an attempt, more or less successful, to persuade the many-headed monster of universal suffrage that the gentleman on whose behalf it is addressed is a paragon of wisdom and virtue. Of Hawthorne's little book, there is nothing particular to say, save that it is in very good taste, that he is a very fairly ingenious advocate, and that if he claimed for the future president qualities which rather faded in the bright light of a high office, this defect of proportion was essential to his undertaking.
That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, got him.
How that? I mean, that's an amazing little artifact about how democracy is viewed.
Yeah. Right?
Like, what is the quote? Which is known as the campaign biography, and which consists of an attempt, more or less successful, to persuade the many-headed monster of universal suffrage that the gentleman on whose behalf it is addressed is a paragon of wisdom and virtue. Of Hawthorne's little book. He always calls things little books. Yes. Kind of this little book here. It's just a little book.
Like little Norman churches as well.
Yeah.
There's nothing particular to say, save that, let's see if we can read between the lines here, save that it is a, that it is in very good taste that he is a, that he is a fairly ingenious advocate. Now, if you say that about like Corey Lewandowski or like Sarah Huckabee Sanders, you know what you mean there.
Well, it's just like the epitome of a backhanded compliment.
And also that's like the very essence of Henry James's prose, this kind of constant qualification. Like, he'll never make a simple statement. You always have to read between the lines, and often you don't know whether you're reading innuendo or sarcasm or sincerity, you know. It's mm-hmm. just like getting lost in a maze, basically.
Right.
Yeah, it's like a maze of introductions between different classes of, like, or like in the democratic way of, like, you know, you talk in a different way to different people if you're a politician. It's almost like Henry James is taking that, like, removing time from that element, and we're like talking to like seven or eight different classes all in like one sentence with clause upon clause upon clause.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, his late work is even it's so impenetrable.
What's the quote he had about Scarlet Letter that you, society is never, is that a Hawthorne or James quote? No, I'm
Which one?
Society, you're never as good as society, except a well-regulated society needs you to be. Let's see if I can find it here. Okay, yeah, here's some more James on Hawthorne.
Then the fact that these duskiest flowers of his invention sprang straight from the soil of his happiest days. This surely indicates that there was but little direct connection between the products of his fancy and the state of his affections. When he was lightest at heart, he was most creative. And when he was most creative, the moral picturesqueness of the old secret of mankind in general, and of the Puritans in particular, most appealed to him. The secret that we are really not by any means so good as a well-regulated society requires us to appear.
Yeah, nice. I just thought that was interesting.
I noticed you use metaphors about time of day all throughout this piece, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Both to describe people and people's relationship to each other.
Which is smart, because Hawthorne uses that shit all the time, too.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, he's obsessed with shadows and dusk. And
the other thing Henry James does, it was noted by one of the two articles I cited, is he talks about novelists in painting terms. So yes. Like chiaroscuro and shit like that.
Yeah, when he went after the transcendentalists for a moment, he said it's a movement that has it's a morning without a noon.
Mm.
Which is like, one, fuck you.
Yeah.
Two,
you can say that about anything.
Yeah, yeah.
Fucking asshole.
It's potential, but then he seemed to say that
so
Emerson
is realism.
Yeah. Emerson, yeah, so is the nuclear age, okay?
I hope so.
I think he just knew he wasn't cool enough to be a transcendentalist.
Thank you, Grace.
I really believe that.
Well, he's definitely... It did sting when he's talking about Emerson. It's form without essence. That it's like, it would have been really great to see Emerson. Of course, what he's talking about is nonsense. But he was an incredible stylist. Mm-hmm. And then to say he had no students is absurd. Like, to be like that, he literally crafted Thoreau out of clay himself. And then Walt Whitman, of course. But then... the unstated thing is that Hawthorne does have disciples, but he won't say who it is. And it's him. He's the noon to Hawthorne's morning. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if he knows that in the piece, but like that's where he's placing himself in that geography, it seems like.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's an interesting dodge to say this thing is, it's not because of its content, but it's because of its form. Mm-hmm. Is the reason why it's successful. It's a good way to ignore the content.
Yeah.
He has this great quote as well about, and going back to light and dark and those, the way those metaphors work in James, he talks about how, he says, Emerson, as a sort of spiritual sun worshipper, could have attached but a moderate value to Hawthorne's cat-like faculty of seeing in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is just a wonderful sentence.
Yeah, that is, yeah, it's more than once he refers to Hawthorne is either dark or evening, which, like, in the short stories we read, that's absolutely who he is.
Well, even in that little bit, he does mention the word dusky, and in that letter, he's like, I use that too much. I'm sorry.
Yeah, sorry. I just, that's the truth.
Crepuscular is another classic James word.
Crepuscular. Yeah.
What is that?
Relating to shadows.
Crepuscular is twilight, right? I know
relating
that.
Relating to shadows. Did you not just hear what she said?
I might put this in, might drop this in, but Will Self, you familiar with Will Self?
Yes.
He wrote that umbrella book that I gave to Aaron and then stole back.
Not even here to defend himself.
Wrote a book about psychogeography, but he was on Russell Brand's radio show once.
Oh,
and Russell
lads.
Was... Yeah, exactly.
Just lads.
Before the interview, Russell was trying to brush up on big words to impress Will Self. And he found out crepuscular is one of Will Self's favorite words.
Oh, that doesn't surprise me. I just want to go back a moment to that idea of darkness and James being kind of drawn to that in Hawthorne. I think if we were to create a Venn diagram of James and Hawthorne, the overlap would be moral complexity, like psychodrama, and the kind of fundamental darkness at the heart of all of these moral tangles that Hawthorne is so interested in and which James would take up later, but he would transplant them to Europe, to England, to
funner places.
Yeah, more exotic climes.
He does the Edgar Allan Poe move.
Which one?
And Poe preferred like European settings.
Oh yeah, that's true.
It's interesting. This story that we're going to move to shortly, Wakefield, was published the same year as Hans Fall.
Oh really?
I didn't make that connection till earlier this week, but
what a vibrant printing culture.
Yeah.
When was Wakefield?
Wakefield was. Do we want to move to Wakefield now?
Is that with a heavy heart?
Any last words on Henry James for now?
There's this section that I quite liked. That
yes,
it could,
Alex, keep the dream alive.
Yeah, it's page 1 through 80. No, where he kind of has a mission statement about his like pan global view of the world, and where America's place in it, basically. It is, I think, an indisputable fact that Americans are, as Americans, the most self-conscious people in the world and the most addicted to the belief that the other nations of the earth are in a conspiracy to undervalue them. They are conscious of being the youngest of great nations, of not being of the European family, of being placed on the circumference of the circle of civilization rather than at the center, of the experimental element not having as yet entirely dropped out of their great political undertaking. The sense of this relativity, in a word, replaces that quiet and comfortable sense of the absolute as regards its own position in the world, which reigns supreme in the British and Gaelic genius.
I love that talking about a certain type of ethnic or racial genius.
Yeah, that's something that you don't hear a whole lot of today.
It just rings It couldn't possibly ring worse to modern ears. Well,
there's that section in the biography where he talks about how when Hawthorne was growing up in Salem, there were no Irish people there. Do you remember that?
Oh, I might have skipped over that. I don't see color, so any
I think I remember
it,
that.
No people of color in Salem at that point.
Exactly.
Matt, I have
an Here it is.
Okay.
Things has kept the reputation of Concord green, and it has been watered, moreover, so to speak.
Oh, yeah, so they're talking about Concord.
Oh, not Salem.
Yeah.
My bad.
Here's Emerson says, in the little hymn which he contributed in 1836 to the dedication of a small monument commemorating this circumstance, "Here once the embattled farmer stood and fired the shot heard round the world. The battle was a small one, and the farmers were not destined individually to emerge from obscurity. But the memory of these things has kept the reputation of Concord green, and it has been watered, moreover, so to speak, by the lifelong presence there of one of the most honored of American men of letters, the poet from whom I just quoted two lines. Concord is indeed in itself decidedly verdant, and is an excellent specimen of a New England village of the riper sort. At the time of Hawthorne's first going there, it must have been an even better specimen than today. More homogeneous, more indigenous, more absolutely democratic.
Mm-hmm.
40 years ago, the tide of foreign immigration had scarcely begun to break upon the rural strongholds of the New England race. It had at most begun to splash them with a salt Hibernian spray.
Awkward.
It's very possible, however, that at this period there was not an Irishman in Concord. The place would have been a village community operating in excellent conditions.
Oh, God.
Such a village community was not the least honorable item in the sum of New England civilization. Its spreading elms and plain white houses, its generous summers and ponderous winters.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was virtually crime-free until the thuggish Irishman showed up with his song and his whatever else they do.
Yeah, I mean... I bet you. I wonder what Henry James thought of the Italian in The House of the Seven Gables.
The organ grinder?
Organ grinder, yeah.
So. He probably would have written indecent letters to him secretly after hours.
You made us continue with Henry James, yeah. And now we've got Henry James.
Turns out he's canceled. Good work.
Yeah.
We do need to talk about his sexuality at some point, but...
That's its own episode.
I think it should be.
But you have some sort of bonus treat for us.
I mean,
will you permit me, Matt?
Yeah, go for it.
This is just a very whimsical excerpt from a letter that I came across in the reading section of Harper's Magazine a few years ago. It was from the April 2014 issue of Harper's. And it's a letter that James wrote to a friend about these fresh eggs that he was having delivered to his house in Chelsea, London. This is when he had relocated to London permanently. And he had this like egg service set up where he would have fresh eggs conveyed to him from his friend in the countryside.
Wow. You know, the U.S. Postal Service delivers eggs and they've delivered eggs for a long time.
Interesting.
But anyway, continue.
So... Yeah, I just want to read this little excerpt.
Sorry, delivers live chickens. Anyway, continue.
Yeah.
Oh, that would be nice. So, yeah, he had a box which he had a box constructed for the purpose of moving these eggs from Gloucestershire to Chelsea in London. And this is the letter. He says, "The box has flown back to you on the wings of all the potential chickens of all the blessed eggs this very day. It was my fault that my good woman," this is his housekeeper, "didn't return it sooner. Good woman, the day it came, said, 'Shall I send it back today, sir?' Modest man says, 'Oh, wouldn't that look rather greedy? Keep it a day or two.' So it was kept longer than I knew. But, as I say, it is flapping straight to Morgan Hall now." Morgan Hall is where the eggs came from. "And it shall always boldly go, henceforth, the very right day. The arrival of the eggs makes me believe in better things. I don't mean better than eggs. There is nothing better. But better than most of the things we have been having. I shall bless you as long as they continue, and even when they have stopped, for the memory of them. But pray, don't let them stop yet a while. Make them rather begin more violently. They console me for certain disappointing events in America. Better the British hen than the American eagle. Drop the mic.
Oh, wow. What a, you know, I'm glad he likes his eggs, all right?
I feel that way about eggs, don't you?
Yeah, I guess I do have them quite a lot. I don't know. Having, if you were able to, like, eat an eagle, though.
The best part of the favorite, starring Emma Stone.
Mm. Which is very Jamesian, I think.
Friend of the pod.
The favorite. Yeah,
when she says, I'm having a something called a pineapple coming. That's a nice touch. Because I think that's all they gave a shit about at the time. Like, we got some fucking good spices.
Yeah.
Some good, it's basically like a Reese's cup. But, like, you would, like, invade a country because, like, we got this amazing little confectionery or something.
Mm. How, like, I feel about Marmite.
Positively?
Very positive, yeah.
Interesting. I only know that it's polarized and I've never tasted it.
Oh, I'll bring some next time for you. Okay, yeah. Sure. I normally keep it in my bag, but don't have it with me today.
The movable feast at any
next,
moment.
I keep it next to my hot sauce.
Yes. My bourbon.
Yeah, all these references are just going to do so well.
Yeah, I know. Shall we get to Wakefield, guys?
I don't know, Matt, do you want to get to Wakefield?
I'm ready to get to it.
Grace, do you want to get to Wakefield?
Got Bob Newfield sitting on the bench over there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You can drag me kicking and screaming into Wakefield.
You'd be like, well, you know what Henry James would think of this.
So, yeah, some stats on Wakefield here. This was, like I said, May 1835, same year as Hans Fall, actually preceded Hans Fall. That was in the New England magazine. And then later, it was republished in Twice Told Tales. That was Hawthorne's first collection of short stories. That also had Young Goodman Brown,
right.
which we read. And The Maple on Marymount as well. So both of those. Now, Twice Told Tales came out March 6th, 1837. For, guess how much it cost?
Like a shilling.
I mean, this is America.
Sorry, I'm in Henry James mode still. Like 2 bits.
A dollar.
A dollar?
Cost
that's
a dollar.
Expensive.
How much is that?
And it was selling, like, fairly decently.
Yeah,
sold,
it's a lot.
Sold 600 to 700 copies by June, but then there was the Panic of 1837.
Uh-oh. Right.
Which was very big, which eventually is why we invaded Mexico.
That's going to be a recurring pattern, by the way, in American history.
I actually got a book on Audible called America's First Great Depression. And then the subtitle is way too small for me to read on this. But I might just do a solo book review of that. Because that, I think this panic comes up a lot, this mm-hmm. 1837 thing. And that basically just destroyed all the sales. It just cratered after that.
Bad timing.
Yeah. So Hawthorne asked Henry Wadsworth Longfellow to write a review for it. Hmm. They were both Bowdoin schoolboys. They didn't know each other terribly well there, but Hawthorne's like, hey, we should catch up. By the way, you mind like reviewing this for me in a publication? Yeah. And he did. That's
you know Franklin Pierce, right?
That's how all this shit works, man.
Yeah.
It's a racket. All right, so here we go. We're going to get to Wakefield by Nathaniel Hawthorne. Very interesting story. I think if you stuck around, you'll enjoy this.
Wakefield, from Twice Told Tales by Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Don't fuck me like
this. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain.
I wish Ian Read McKellen was Bob reading Newfell. This.
Yeah. Oh. But he would make
in some old magazine or newspaper, I recollect a story told as truth of a man, let us call him Wakefield, who absented himself for a long time from his wife. The fact thus so, abstract.
Just to rewind, two things we've already covered, two themes, is this is a story from a magazine or a newspaper, mm-hmm. so similar to Hans Fall.
Mm-hmm. I make that connection.
Also, And also, like I said, this is the exact same year that came out. Also, another guy leaving his wife. Like
that's maybe the, one of the that's a through that's line the main of what we've been talking
thing
about.
Like so young Goodman Brown, Rip yeah. Van Winkle, this
I definitely noticed. Oh yeah, yeah,
Hans Fall.
Yeah,
yeah,
and they keep riffing on it. It's not always the same. Like sometimes she's like the hag, and then sometimes she's actually like better for it. But it's always the idea of it's always the instigator is the husband has got to get away from his wife for yeah. some reason or the other.
Got,
that's just, high fantasy. That's like that is like what's that show that everyone likes right now? The wizard one. The one about dragons. Game of Thrones. That's the Game of Thrones yeah. of 19th century.
Oh my God.
Just cut all that out. Of like the 19th century is like, can you imagine a world without your wife?
Yeah. Can you imagine leaving your wife for the night or even for a long, longer period yeah. of that?
A week? I don't know. Maybe a space Look, the travel?
Let your imagination go crazy. Yeah. This is an archetype we can return to over and over again.
It's like a writing prompt for the 19th century. Like, imagine your wife. Now imagine she's not there.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my God.
How did that happen? Okay, here we go.
Recording is in the public domain. Read by Bob Neufeld. In some old magazine or newspaper, I recollect a story, told as truth, of a man, let us call him Wakefield, who absented himself for a long time from his wife. The fact, thus abstractedly stated, is not very uncommon, nor, without a proper distinction of circumstances, to be condemned either as naughty or nonsensical. Howbeit, this, though far from the most aggravated, is perhaps the strangest instance on record of marital delinquency, and moreover, as remarkable a freak as may be found in the freak. Whole list of human oddities. The wedded couple lived in London. The man, under pretense of going on a journey, took lodgings in the next street to his own house, and there, unheard of by his wife or friends, and without the shadow of a reason for such self-banishment, dwelt upward of 20 years. During that period he beheld his home every day, and frequently the forlorn Mrs. Wakefield. And after so great a gap in his matrimonial felicity, when his death was reckoned certain, his estate settled, his name dismissed from memory, and his wife long, long ago resigned to her autumnal widowhood, he entered the door one evening quietly as from a day's absence, and became a loving spouse till death. This outline is all that I remember, but the incident, though of the purest originality, unexampled and probably never to be repeated, is one, I think, which appeals to the general sympathies of mankind. We know, each for himself, that none of us would perpetuate such a folly, yet feel as if some other might. To my own contemplations, at least, it has often recurred, always exciting wonder, but with a sense that the story must be true and a conception of its hero's character. Whenever any...
It's a good thing they didn't have Snopes back then to buzzkill him.
Yeah, it would have ended it right
I would have
there.
Been a skeptic being like, no, I've looked this up. I haven't found this in any magazine. Gentleman's is your, Magazine.
Is that your Ben Shapiro voice?
I don't know. That, yeah.
Well, facts don't care about your feelings.
Sorry, this didn't even happen.
But with a sense that the story must be true and a conception of its hero's character. Whenever any subject so forcibly affects the mind, time is well spent in thinking of it. If the reader choose, let him do his own meditation, or if he prefer to ramble with me through the 20 years of Wakefield's vagary, I bid him welcome, trusting that there will be a pervading spirit and a moral, even should we fail to find them, done up neatly and condensed into the final sentence.
That's a weird little section, because he's like, we have this weird story. Mm-hmm. You can go off on your own little imagination. You can stop reading now. Just I've given you enough.
Yeah.
Go think about that.
It's like the original TLDR or whatever.
or stick with me. And even though there's not a moral to this story, which... he doesn't ever say that even though this story might just be awful... Like, what I'm telling you might just be cruel and seem kind of pointless. I'm going to package it in a way that makes everybody, you know, leave having learned something.
Yeah, it's definitely ground that he's trod before, but I think it's in the upper stratosphere of complexity. It does remind me of Young Goodman Brown, but the allegory nature of it.
Yeah.
That remember you would talk about that writing for two audiences, you know, it's like ones who actually believe in like the mythology of what's happening, the other ones are reading the allegorical intent. This is the one, this is the same story without the like the ornamentation of the devil being there and like creatures.
Yeah, just same, a weird freak. He uses the word freak.
Yeah, the same like existential longing is there, like in the, but that accompanies someone journeying in the middle of the night. So maybe he's telling that audience, like,
if the reader choose, let him do his own meditation. Or if he prefer to ramble with me through the 20 years of Wakefield's vagary, I bid him welcome, trusting that there will be a pervading spirit and a moral, even should we fail to find them, done up neatly and condensed into the final sentence. Thought has always its efficacy, and every striking incident its moral. What sort of a man was Wakefield? We are free to shape out our own idea and call it by his name. He was now in the meridian of life. His matrimonial affections, never violent, were sobered into a calm, habitual sentiment. Of all husbands, he was likely to be the most constant, because a certain sluggishness would keep his heart at rest wherever it might be placed. He was intellectual, but not actively so. His mind occupied itself in long and lazy musings that tended to no purpose or had no vigor to attain it. His thoughts were seldom so energetic as to seize hold of words. Imagination, in the proper meaning of the term, made no part of Wakefield's gifts. With a cold but not depraved nor wandering heart, and a mind never feverish with riotous thoughts nor perplexed with originality, who could have anticipated that our friend would entitle himself to a foremost place among the doers of eccentric deeds? Had his acquaintances been asked, who was the man?
He likes the artistic nature of what he does here. Like, you really pulled something off here.
Yeah.
You're a doer of it. Like, yeah, like, there's something, there's some, like, admiration here.
Well, to tie it back to Henry James's analysis of Hawthorne, he calls him, like, a Twilight kind of figure.
Mm-hmm.
This is Hawthorne writing about another Twilight figure, but the Twilight is in reverse, where it's the dead meridian, where he's not absolutely anything in the way that Twilight is neither, like, day nor dark. This person is halfway towards everything.
Yeah.
And he can't make a decision. So there's some camaraderie between Hawthorne and this character, but he's like the absolute inverse of what Hawthorne makes something out of it, and this guy just uses it as a reason to coast through life, basically.
Yeah, Hawthorne, like, we've mentioned it on pretty much every episode, but he's obsessed with Twilight and like that midnight thing.
Yeah.
With a cold but not depraved nor wandering heart, and a mind never feverish with riotous thoughts nor perplexed with originality, who could have anticipated that our friend would entitle himself to a foremost place among the doers of eccentric deeds? Had his acquaintances been asked, who was the man in London the surest to perform nothing today which should be remembered on the morrow, they would have thought of Wakefield.
Most boring man award.
Only the wife of his bosom might have hesitated. She, without having analyzed his character, was partly aware of a quiet selfishness that had rusted into his inactive mind, of a peculiar sort of vanity, the most uneasy attribute about him, of a disposition to craft which had seldom produced more positive effects than the keeping of petty secrets hardly worth revealing, and lastly, of what she called a little strangeness sometimes in the good man. This latter quality was indefinable, and perhaps non-existent. Let us now imagine Wakefield bidding adieu to his wife. It is the dusk of an October evening. His equipment is a drab greatcoat, a hat covered with an oilcloth, top boots, an umbrella in one hand, and a small portmanteau in the other. He has informed Mrs. Wakefield that he is to take the night coach into the country. She would fain inquire the length of his journey, its object, and the probable time of his return, but, indulgent to his harmless love of mystery, interrogates him only by a look. He tells her not to expect him positively by the return coach, nor to be alarmed should he tarry 3 or 4 days, but at all events to look for him at supper on Friday evening. Wakefield himself, be it considered, has no suspicion of what is before him. He holds out his hand. She gives her own, and meets his parting kiss in the matter-of-course way of a 10 years' matrimony, and forth goes the middle-aged Mr. Wakefield, almost resolved to perplex his good lady by a whole week's absence. After the door has closed behind him, she perceives it thrust partly open, and a vision of her husband's face through the aperture, smiling on her and gone in a moment. For the time, this little incident is dismissed without a thought, but long afterward, when she has been more years as a widow than a wife, that smile recurs and flickers across all her reminiscences of Wakefield's visage. And her,
I just want to point out that part, that he leaves and there's this little smile that she remembers later. That is, I think, really creepy, part of this story.
For the time, this little incident is dismissed without a thought. But long afterward, when she has been more years as a widow than a wife, that smile recurs and flickers across all her reminiscences of Wakefield's visage. In her many musings, she surrounds the original smile with a multitude of fantasies which make it strange and awful. As, for instance, if she imagines him in a coffin, that parting look is frozen on his pale features. Or if she dreams of him in heaven, still his blessed spirit wears a quiet and crafty smile. Yet for its sake, when all others have given him up for dead, she sometimes doubts whether she is a widow. But our business is with the husband. We must hurry after him along the street, ere he lose his individuality and melt into the great mass of London life. It would be vain searching for him there. Let us follow close at his heels, therefore, until, after several superfluous turns and doublings, we find him comfortably established by the fireside of a small apartment previously bespoken. He is in the next street to his own, and at his journey's end. He can scarcely trust his good fortune in having got thither unperceived, recollecting that at one time he was delayed by the throng in the very focus of a lighted lantern, and again there were footsteps that seemed to tread behind his own, distinct from the multitudinous tramp around him, and anon he heard a voice shouting afar, and fancied that it called his name. Doubtless a dozen busybodies had been watching him, and told his wife the whole affair. Poor Wakefield! Little knowest thou thine own significance in this great world. No mortal eye but mine has traced thee. Go quietly to thy bed, foolish man, and on the morrow, if thou wilt be wise, get thee home to good Mrs. Wakefield, and tell her the truth. Remove not thyself even for a little week from thy place in her chaste bosom. Were she for a single moment to deem thee dead, or lost, or lastingly divided from her, thou wouldst be woefully conscious of a change in thy true wife for ever after. It is perilous to make a chasm in human affections, not that they gape so long and wide, but so quickly close again. Almost repenting of his frolic, or whatever it may be termed, Wakefield lies down betimes, and starting from his first nap, spreads forth his arms into the wide and solitary waste of the unaccustomed bed. No, thinks he, gathering the bedclothes about him, I will not sleep alone another night. In the morning he rises earlier than usual, and sets himself to consider what he really means to do. Such are his loose and rambling modes of thought, that he has taken this very singular step with the consciousness of a purpose, indeed, but without being able to define it sufficiently for his own contemplation. The vagueness of the project and the convulsive effort with which he plunges into the execution of it are equally characteristic of a feeble-minded man. Wakefield sifts his ideas, however, as minutely as he may, and finds himself curious to know the progress of matters at home, how his exact wife will endure her widowhood of a week, and briefly as he may, and finds himself curious to know the progress of matters at home, how his exemplary wife will endure her widowhood of a week, and briefly how the little sphere of creatures and circumstances in which he was a central object will be affected by his removal. A morbid vanity, therefore, lies nearest the bottom of the affair.
I find that excerpt in particular very direct, very relatable, even today. When I read it, I thought about, thankfully, like more of a younger me, that I would get into like a habit of someone who had just started dating, if you no longer were dating that person, that there was this morbid obsession of like, I wonder what they're doing.
Oh, yes.
And not so like, it was almost undescribable, because it wasn't like, I wonder if they're talking about me. It's like, I wonder how they exist without me.
Yeah.
And it shows this level of like an immature mind that it's like, you haven't fully grasped that this person is an autonomous person yet, that they're only a B character in your life. And like looking at their Facebook or whatever social media is just a way of being like, what a novelty that this person that was a B character is actually a real person.
Yeah. They're getting drinks with friends.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just like, you have like, it's weird. And you eventually, thankfully, you grow out of that. Like, oh, I don't need to like do that with people that were nice enough.
I don't grow out of it. I just cultivate. Oh, well. I'll just cultivate those sorts of.
Yeah, I can't believe this person kissed me, compulsions. And now they're like going to a wedding. What a psycho!
Yeah, it is so. Like, this is why if you're going through a breakup, you're probably going to need to unfollow that person at least. Like, even if it's like amicable.
Yeah, yeah.
And even if it's like you're trying to be friends, like you're probably not going to want to see that Instagram feed for a good year.
Yeah.
Speaking from personal advice. But yeah, it's so weird to absent yourself, though. Like, right now you could do it without living the house across the street, right? You could move to wherever and definitely not be found out and just watch their online behavior.
Digitally, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, that wouldn't be as fun, I guess, as looking with binoculars.
But I think that's what makes this story terribly prescient for today, because I think people live their lives doing what he does in a compartmentalized form. They don't fully attribute their lives to disappearing, but there are moments where it's like, I want to not exist and view other people. And you can do that now.
And, you know, I never had this urge. I don't really know. I can't really relate to it. But when people talk about wanting to see their own funeral, this is sort of like viewing your own absence. Like, what am I? Like, I'm just going to take myself. It's sort of like control. It's like an experiment, right? Like, I'm controlling for this experiment. Here's the conditions with me. Here's the conditions without me. And then you can get a sense of what exactly effect do you have on the world.
Yeah.
And all this. Yeah.
What's it's the frustration that you never get to see yourself like other people get to see you, which is this whole story that you can try to remove yourself from your own life as to the point where Wakefield literally just sits around the corner watching his life, trying to get an outside perspective on his own life.
Yeah.
I don't know, in the way that Henry James couldn't get a perspective on Hawthorne. It's too close.
Yeah.
And that's like the unending frustration.
And I mean, I'll just note here, the Bryan Cranston version, it appears that he moves into like a garage. I don't know if it's the family garage or someone else's garage.
I gotta go get soda in the garage. No, don't go in there.
Can see Jennifer Garner like, you know, coping with everything. That was based on the E.L. Doctorow adaptation written in the New Yorker in the 2000s, which I'll be honest, I'm going to stick with The March or really? Ragtime, because that is pretty, it's just Wakefield with new nouns.
Like, I can't imagine that this needs to live on in any other medium than it currently resides.
It was much longer than the original.
That's the first mistake.
Yeah, exactly. Here it is.
Matters at home. How his exemplary wife will endure her widowhood of a week. And briefly, how the little sphere of creatures and circumstances in which he was a central object will be affected by his removal. A morbid vanity, therefore, lies nearest the bottom of the affair.
Mm-hmm.
But how is he to attain his ends? Not, certainly, by keeping close in this comfortable lodging, where, though he slept and awoke in the next street to his home, he is as effectually abroad as if the stagecoach had been whirling him away all night. Yet should he reappear, the whole project is knocked in the head. His poor brains being hopelessly puzzled with this dilemma, he at length ventures out, partly resolving to cross the head of the street and send one hasty glance toward his forsaken domicile. Habit, for he is a man of habit, takes him by the hand and guides him, wholly unaware, to his own door, where, just at the critical moment, he is aroused by the scraping of his foot upon the step. "Wakefield, whither are you going?" At that instant his fate was turning on the pivot. Little dreaming of the doom to which his first backward step devotes him, he hurries away, breathless with agitation hitherto unfelt, and hardly dares turn his head at the distant corner. Can it be that nobody caught sight of him? Will not the whole household, the decent Mrs. Wakefield, the smart maid-servant, and the dirty little footboy, raise a hue and cry through London streets in pursuit of their fugitive lord and master? Wonderful escape! He gathers courage to pause and look homeward, but is perplexed with a sense of change about the familiar edifice, such as affects us all when, after a separation of months or years, we again see some hill or lake or work of art with which we were friends of old. In ordinary cases, this indescribable impression is caused by the comparison and contrast between our imperfect reminiscences and the reality. In Wakefield, the magic of a single night has wrought a similar transformation, because in that brief period a great moral change has been effected. But this is a secret from himself. Before leaving the spot, he catches a far and momentary glimpse of his wife passing athwart the front window with her face turned toward the head of the street. The crafty nincompoop takes to his heels, scared with the eye that among a thousand... such atoms of mortality, her eye must have detected him. Right glad is his heart, though his brain be somewhat dizzy, when he finds himself by the coal fire of his lodgings. So much for the commencement of his long whim-wham. After the initial conception and the stirring up of the man's sluggish temperament to put it in practice, the whole matter evolves itself in a natural train. We may suppose him, as the result of deep deliberation, buying a new wig of reddish hair and selecting sundry garments, in a fashion unlike his customary suit of brown, from a Jew's old clothes bag. It is accomplished. Wakefield...
Interesting two notes. One... The Jew's old clothes bag is an interesting note. Just for me, I was reading a book on the Fargo-Moorhead area, and it was talking about early Jewish settlers, and they were like clothiers and tailors and that sort of thing. Amazing how racialized that, or ethnicized, I guess, certain industries are like that. But love and costumes. I mean, now it's getting a little bit more like self-conscious about costumes, but like Hope Leslie's got costumes. Roger Chillingham's always in costumes. The spy, the costumes, like George Washington, like the 19th century, they fucking love costumes. But
there's a nice comparison with the sentence from a Jew's old clothes bag, and the next line is "it is accomplished," which I can't help but feel is a reference to the gospel story, because that's what Christ says. That's his last phrase on the cross before he dies and is born again. So it is accomplished. So he's like the Christ of his own story, and then the next line is "Wakefield is another man." So he's gone through this like resurrection phrase, and then he's also playing on the idea of wearing like Jewish garb, and but I don't really know where it goes. It's just kind of,
if you're a college student, you could steal that and put that in your paper, because
I am a college student right now. I'm still finishing my undergrad in May.
Are you gonna write about
on the Hawthorne guy at Brooklyn College?
You're doing Hawthorne. You're gonna be a Hawthorne PhD. Steal that, because that's a very good I don't think anyone's commented on that before.
The whole matter evolves itself in a natural train. We may suppose him, as the result of deep deliberation, buying a new wig of reddish hair and selecting sundry garments, in a fashion unlike his customary suit of brown, from a Jew's old clothes bag. It is accomplished. Wakefield is another man. The new system being now established, a retrograde movement to the old would be almost as difficult as the step that placed him in his unparalleled position. Furthermore, he is rendered obstinate by a sulkiness occasionally incident to his temper, and brought on at present by the inadequate sensation which he conceives to have been produced in the bosom of Mrs. Wakefield. He will not go back until she be frightened half to death. Well, twice or thrice has she passed before his sight, each time with a heavier step, a paler cheek, and more anxious brow.
Sadistic.
And in the third week of his non-appearance, he detects a portent of evil entering the house in the guise of an apothecary. Next day, the knocker is muffled. Toward nightfall comes the chariot of a physician, and deposits its big-wigged and solemn burden at Wakefield's door, whence, after a quarter of an hour's visit, he emerges, perchance the herald of a funeral. Dear woman, will she die? By this time, Wakefield is excited to something like energy of feeling. But
I'd fucking hope so.
Yeah.
Something like energy of feeling. Like, it looks like your wife's gonna die because of what you're doing actively to her at that moment.
This second time around for me is way more perverse than when I read it earlier.
It is just like, it's... And like, I think the frame narrative... and the narrator occasionally like addressing Wakefield in person sort of helps you distance from the grotesque cruelty of what's happening, but it's still kind of fucked up. Like, because he talks about like, you could have gone off and imagined any story to go around these details about this man leaving his wife and then coming back. But weren't you, and I guess like maybe it's hard to write one that isn't sadistic and cruel. But it seems like he's relishing it a little bit or something.
Yeah, for sure. It's really voyeuristic as well.
Yeah.
In a very troubling way.
I wonder, reading it, if you were to look at it as like a parable, how much of it is that even though, like if Wakefield never left, like physically left the domicile with his wife, if this would have been the natural conclusion of their relationship anyways, that he gets more and more checked out. Like with his own life and their relationship, that it would be like as if he is a hollow man with his wife. And it's kind of like, it's interesting about the narrator imploring him to like react to the world around him. It's not necessarily like he's like, go back to her. It could almost just be like what he's saying to someone who's on the verge, like had a midlife crisis and the crisis won.
Spending too much time in the man cave.
Yes, exactly. Like one too many hours with the model trains.
Right.
I mean, it is in a way like an examination of what would happen if somebody were to act on their fantasy, their kind of like midlife crisis fantasy of just blowing up their life and walking out.
Yeah. And I'm not a huge fan of a lot of there's not a lot of good criticism from my search anyway of this, but one of them was like, this seems making the case that this seems very clearly to be the narrator's fantasy that he's projecting onto like a story or something like that.
And yet I think he does go to some pains to present Wakefield as like something of a pathetic figure, you know, like I think when he says, he calls him a crafty nincompoop for one, but this idea that his poor brains are hopelessly puzzled by his impulses, like he lacks self-knowledge and that is why he does this.
But he does such a weird thing for somebody who's lacking self-knowledge. That's the weird thing about it. I mean, this seems like something a psychopath does, but you don't think of them. You think of them as being overly self-knowledgeable, right? Like, because that's how they.
That's true.
But I think the urge is Hawthorne or the narrator, let's say, can relate to, which is to see your own life honestly from like a third party perspective.
Yes.
But the way to get to that, which is for him to abandon all responsibility, that's what makes it perverse. But I think that this character, it can't get out of the fiction, which none of us can do, but that's the writer's impulse is to like see the world honestly, or the artist's impulse essentially is like to see the world honestly. And the narrator, who we can assume is Hawthorne, is like, you're doing what I'm trying to do.
Right.
And that's what makes it perverse, that you're trying to like, I think the French philosopher, Corin says that like a completed novel is a, suicide successfully postponed, because it's like you can't deal with the absurdity of life unless you like are able to remove yourself slightly and think about it deeply and create a novel. Or like Proust's idea of like a novel is is his chance to live his life honestly, to like to really talk about like how he felt in the moment rather than to like live up to like niceties and bullshit. And so this person wants to do that too. He wants to like see his silhouette, but is doing it in a perverse fashion, which is really damaging his family in a way that Hawthorne is like, no, this is how you do it. You write about it.
Like he's taking something literally that should be done metaphorically understood metaphorically.
In the guise of an apothecary. Next day, the knocker is muffled. Toward nightfall comes the chariot of a physician and deposits its big-wigged and solemn burden at Wakefield's door, whence, after a quarter of an hour's visit, he emerges, perchance the herald of a funeral. Dear woman, will she die? By this time, Wakefield is excited to something like energy of feeling, but still lingers away from his wife's bedside, pleading with his conscience that she must not be disturbed at such a juncture. If aught else restrains him, he does not know it. In the course of a few weeks, she gradually recovers. The crisis is over. Her heart is sad, perhaps, but quiet. And let him return soon or late, it will never be feverish for him again. Such ideas glimmer through the mist of Wakefield's mind, and render him indistinctly conscious that an almost impassable gulf divides his hired apartment from his former home. "It is but in the next street," he sometimes says. "Fool, it is in another world!" Hitherto he has put off his return from one particular day to another. Henceforward he leaves the precise time undetermined. Not tomorrow, probably next week, but pretty soon. Poor man! The dead have nearly as much chance of revisiting their earthly homes as the self-banished Wakefield. Would that I had a folio to write instead of an article of a dozen pages. Then might I exemplify how an influence beyond our control lays its strong hand on every deed which we do and weaves its consequences into an iron tissue of necessity. Wakefield is spellbound. We must leave him for 10 years or so to haunt around his house without once crossing the threshold, and to be faithful to his wife with all the affection of which his heart is capable, while he is slowly fading out of hers. Long since, it must be remarked, he has lost the perception of singularity in his conduct. Now for a scene. Amid the throng of a London street, we distinguish a man, now waxing elderly, with few characteristics to attract careless observers, yet bearing in his whole aspect the handwriting of no common fate, for such as have the skill to read it. He is meagre. His low and narrow forehead is deeply wrinkled. His eyes, small and lustreless, sometimes wander apprehensively about him, but oftener seem to look inward. He bends his head, and moves with an indescribable obliquity of gait, as if unwilling to display his full front to the world. Watch him long enough to see what we have described, and you will allow that circumstances, which often produce remarkable men from nature's ordinary handwork, have produced one such here. Next, leaving him to sidle along the footwalk, cast your eyes in the opposite direction, where a portly female, considerably in the wane of life, with a prayer-book in her hand, is proceeding to yonder church. She has the placid mien of settled widowhood. Her regrets have either died away or have become so essential to her heart that they would be poorly exchanged for joy. Just as the lean man and well-conditioned woman are passing, a slight obstruction occurs and brings these two figures directly in contact. Their hands touch. The pressure of the crowd forces her bosom against his shoulder. They stand face to face, staring into each other's eyes. After a 10 years' separation, thus Wakefield meets his wife. The throng eddies away and carries them asunder. The sober widow, resuming her former pace, proceeds to church, but pauses in the portal and throws a perplexed glance along the street. She passes in, however, opening her prayer book as she goes.
So she doesn't recognize him, I think, right? Yeah.
She passes in, however, opening her prayer book as she goes. And the man, with so wild a face that busy and selfish London stands to gaze after him, he hurries to his lodgings, bolts the door, and throws himself upon the bed. The latent feelings of years break out. His feeble mind acquires a brief energy from their strength. All the miserable strangeness of his life is revealed to him at a glance, and he cries out passionately, "Wakefield, you are mad!"
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps he was so. The singularity of his situation must have so molded him to itself that, considered in regard to his fellow creatures and the business of life, he could not be said to possess his right mind. He had contrived, or rather he had happened, to dissever himself from the world, to vanish, to give up his place and privileges with living men without being admitted among the dead. The life of a hermit is no wise parallel to his. He was in the bustle of the city as of old, but the crowd swept by and saw him not. He was, we may figuratively say, always beside his wife and at his hearth, yet must never feel the warmth of the one nor the affection of the other. It was Wakefield's unprecedented fate to retain his original share of human sympathies and to be still involved in human interests while he had lost his reciprocal influence on them. It would be a most curious speculation to trace out the effect of such circumstances on his heart and intellect separately and in unison. Yet, changed as he was, he would seldom be conscious of it, but deem himself the same man as ever. Glimpses of the truth, indeed, would come, but only for the moment, and still he would keep saying, "I shall soon go back," nor reflect that he had been saying so for 20 years. I conceive also that these 20 years...
Yeah, I like that image a lot of... It's like he's near his fire and can't feel it.
Yeah, that's great.
That's a great metaphor for how we can all get stuck in that trap, how we live our life, like constantly analyzing it rather than understanding. It's hard to not talk about it without getting into cliches, but the idea of like living in the moment or respecting the current present time for what it is rather than like not being present,
well,
basically.
And I also like it just as a registry of that the hearth, the fireplace, is where all of that gets sort of collapsed into. That's the symbol that represents, mm-hmm. especially at this time. I mean, we saw that in Seven Gables too, right? Like it's nice to be around the fireplace, but like if you have trains and are going around all these places, who cares so much, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I read this as kind of, he seems to like haunt his former life or the scenes of his former life in some way, and that he's consigned himself to a kind of like living death, basically.
Yeah.
A sort of purgatory.
It's just very ghost-like.
Which, yeah. That's, I mean, I feel like we all go into states of that, but then there's also those people flood modernity, the ones that are just like in this like liminal state that have been alienated from any kind of purpose.
Well, I mean, our generation is the generation that basically does The Sims and shit like that instead of actually having a house, right? Like, it's all simulation. We simulate our friendships, basically.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Saying, "I shall soon go back," nor reflect that he had been saying so for 20 years. I conceive also that these 20 years would appear in the retrospect scarcely longer than the week to which Wakefield had at first limited his absence. He would look on the affair as no more than an interlude in the main business of his life. When, after a little while more, he should deem it time to re-enter his parlour, his wife would clap her hands for joy on beholding the middle-aged Mr. Wakefield. Alas, what a mistake! Would time but await the close of our favorite follies, we should be young men, all of us, and till doomsday. One evening, in the 20th year since he vanished, Wakefield is taking his customary walk toward the dwelling which he still calls his own. It is a gusty night of autumn, with frequent showers that patter down upon the pavement and are gone before a man can put up his umbrella. Pausing near the house, Wakefield discerns through the parlor windows of the second floor the red glow and the glimmer and fitful flash of a comfortable fire. On the ceiling appears a grotesque shadow of good Mrs. Wakefield. The cap, the nose and chin, and the broad waist form an admirable caricature, which dances, moreover, with the upflickering and down-sinking blaze almost too merrily for the shade of an elderly widow. At this instant a shower chances to fall, and is driven by the unmannerly gust full into Wakefield's face and bosom.
Dark stormy night.
He is quite penetrated with its autumnal chill. Shall he stand wet and shivering here, when his own hearth has a good fire to warm him, and his own wife will run to fetch the grey coat and small clothes, which doubtless she has kept carefully in the closet of their bedchamber? No, Wakefield is no such fool. He ascends the steps, heavily, for 20 years have stiffened his legs since he came down, but he knows it not. Stay, Wakefield, would you go to the sole home that is left you? Then step into your grave. The door opens. As he passes in, we have a parting glimpse of his visage, and recognize the crafty smile which was the precursor of the little joke that he has ever since been playing off at his wife's expense.
That weird smile.
How unmercifully has he quizzed the poor woman.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a good night's rest to Wakefield. This happy event, supposing it to be such, could only have occurred at an unpremeditated moment. We will not follow our friend across the threshold. He has left us much food for thought, a portion of which shall lend its wisdom to a moral and be shaped into a figure. Amid the seeming confusion of our mysterious world, individuals are so nicely adjusted to a system, and systems to one another and to the whole, that by stepping aside for a moment, a man exposes himself to a fearful risk of losing his place forever. Like Wakefield, he may become, as it were, the outcast of the universe. End of Wakefield.
Damn.
Oh, that last paragraph.
The outcast of the universe. Yeah.
Yeah, modernism.
Yeah, that's the cost of leaving this rigid, destructive system that that existence is so strange that you don't even know how strange it is. Yeah. That you'll just be a nothing. A vagrant thought.
That.
Yeah.
Man. I mean, some things I guess I just... It's interesting that he seems to want to get caught. Like, he walks up to the front door and he's like, nobody saw this?
Yeah.
Or some guys say, hey, Wakefield. He's like, oh, surely someone's going to tell my wife that Wakefield was seen. Like, no. It's not really that serious.
Well, this whole thing is like a massive self-indulgent fantasy on his part, right?
It's right,
like,
exactly.
Look how much they miss me.
Yeah, and like realizing like, no, buddy. Like,
she's moved on.
It's like that Joyce quote that like absence is the highest form of presence. Or that you're the fact that you're not at the party and people are talking about you, it's like the best version of yourself that could possibly exist.
Yeah, and there's also that bit... Where he's talking about if I had a folio to write and not just some pages, mm-hmm. I would talk. Let me get that.
And also thinking about Hawthorne's own self-consciousness about his reputation, which is mentioned in the James biography, that he was very self-effacing about how few people knew his work and how modest his reputation was.
Yeah, he says, would that I had a folio to write instead of an article of a dozen pages. Then I might exemplify how an influence beyond our control lays its strong hand on every deed which we do and weaves its consequences into an iron tissue of necessity. Now, I have a book recommendation based on that. Hmm. It's called Strangers to Ourselves by Timothy Wilson. This is a Harvard University Press book. Very good. But also will fuck you up because
that's how real it is.
It's about the adaptive unconscious. That's a oh shit. I searched the Wikipedia and it comes up with an album by
the psychologist.
Yeah, he's a psychologist. Oh yeah. So here's the blurb for this by Timothy Wilson. He's a psychology. I'm not sure what his exact credentials are. It doesn't say here on this blurb, but here it writes, "Know thyself, a precept as old as Socrates, is still good advice, but is introspection the best path to self-knowledge? What are we trying to discover anyway? In an eye-opening tour of the unconscious, as contemporary psychological science has redefined it, Timothy D. Wilson introduces us to a hidden mental world of judgments, feelings, and motives that introspection may never show us. This is not your psychoanalyst's unconscious. The adaptive unconscious that empirical psychology has revealed and that Wilson describes is much more than a repository of primitive drives and conflict-ridden memories. It is a set of pervasive, sophisticated mental processes that size up our worlds, set goals, and initiate action, all while we are consciously thinking about something else." And basically the idea is we rationalize our behavior after the fact, and we impose a narrative on it rather than being in control of it ourselves. And check out that book. I mean, it's pretty fucking crazy.
Yeah, I think that the cosmic horror of this story is that Wakefield had built himself up to be ready to be a ghost among the people that he loves, but in doing so, he didn't realize that he's actually a ghost of himself, like to his own self as well, which is, that's the truly horrifying moment, that he doesn't, not only is he gone from their lives, he's not even present for his own life. He's just a nothing.
And we also mentioned Hawthorne after his college life, before he was a working writer. He basically lived with his family, and they left his dinner at the door. Mm. And he was
very reclusive.
Yeah, reclusive. And James gets into this too. And you can see a bit why this story might have strung such a chord with Hawthorne.
Yeah.
All right. I think that's just about does it for this episode. Thank you, Grace and Alex, once again for joining us.
We did it.
Thank you.
And look forward for more with us. We might try to get another one before Grace leaves us once again.
Ooh, yes.
We'll see if that's possible. But patreon.com/literaryhangover if you want to support us. Also, we're getting close to getting monetized on YouTube, or at least hitting the metrics. So check that out there.
It's the best of both worlds. Jeff Bezos doesn't get a build here, and you get his money.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. Literary Hangover, we are out.